This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ritupana Patkari. Today, I'm going to be in conversation with Eva Illouz. Eva Illouz is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Her research focuses on the sociology of capitalism, the sociology of emotions, the sociology of gender, and the sociology of culture. Her work explores several significant and thought-provoking themes, such as the influence of capitalism on emotions, the commodification of romance, and the meaning of freedom, choice, and individualism in the modern world. Some of her major works are Consuming the Romantic Utopia, Love and the Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, University of California Press, 1997, Cold Intimacies, The Making of Emotional Capitalism, Polity Press, 2007, and Why Love Hurts, A Sociological Explanation, Polity Press 2012. Today, in this interview, we will be discussing her recent book, The End of Love, A Sociology of Negative Relations. The first edition was published by the Oxford University Press in 2019, whereas the latest edition has been out with the Polity Press in 2021. I'm so glad to have you here today. Welcome to this interview.
Hello, Ritupana. Thank you very much for having me.
Right. So may I begin the conversation by asking you your motivation behind writing this book, if you could talk a little bit about it for our listeners?
Oh, yes. Thank you. You know, sometimes books have a way to impose themselves on you. So I was very much interested in understanding why so many people around me, as well as myself, experienced love as something very, very elusive. And I would say, in fact, that it is the elusiveness that of love that is the topic of this book. So I don't know if I would say there is or was a very clear motivation, in the sense that it was something simply that it imposed itself on me, both in my experience and in what I could see of others' experience, which suggested the extraordinary volatility of relationships And I had worked before on romantic love as a kind of solid topic. And what I found really interesting and perhaps challenging here in this book was precisely to grasp and to find sociological categories around, these things that I just mentioned, elusiveness and volatility. So that's one thing I think that happened to me. I think also that there was another reason for writing the book. You know, in parallel to my work on emotions, I have also worked on the history and sociology of psychology as a new modern cultural outlook, which shapes the ways in which people understand their interiority and understand their emotions and manage their emotions. I worked quite a lot also on models of mental health and the ways in which these models of mental health compel us to work on our emotions. So I've worked quite a bit on undermining, in a way, the psychological worldview. And I was trying to actually study a phenomenon that is very much usually taken care of by psychologists, namely the fact that people have difficulties holding on into relationships. I was trying to take that object and ask what it would be like to give it a sociological explanation and to go beyond the cliches that men are from Mars and women from Venus. So it's really an attempt, in fact, to understand the malaise of heterosexuality from the standpoint of sociology.
So could you talk about one of the central concepts that you use in the book, which is unloving, and what does it mean from a sociological perspective?
As I just mentioned, I try to study a kind of negative phenomenon. And when I mean by negative, I mean the fact that it is that a social bond does not come into being, or the fact that a social bond does not last. So in a way, I was made to go back to the origins of sociology. And you may remember that Emil Durkheim, one of the founders of sociology, wrote an essay that is called Suicide, a study on suicide. And in this essay, Durkheim really inaugurates, really starts, in fact, the discipline of sociology in 1897. And he starts it by trying to understand suicide not as a mental pathology, but as the result of sociological factors. So the fact that you would be unmarried, for example, or a Protestant or a man, for him very much increased the likelihood of suicide. And so what he was made to do in that study is to posit that something that he called anomie, that is the collapse of norms and the collapse of social bond, very much increased the likelihood of suicide. And this was before, it was about 15 years before he would write another major, I would say, sociological essay on religious ritual. And so with these two studies, in my opinion, you have a great deal of sociology, because his analysis of religion was about the strength, the fact that religious bonds and religious beliefs produce a great deal of solidarity. And suicide was about what happens when these bonds of solidarity break down. And so unloving, if you want, emerges from this tradition and asks, what is it that must happen for relationships not to form? What is the process by which relationships end, or end quickly, in fact, or actually never gel? And so my view on this is that it's a process of that resembles a little bit like a gas. It's a gas state of relationship. It's not fluid, it's not liquid, but it's a state of diffuse undoing. So unloving means something different from what sociologists usually study, which is divorce. And it's different because divorce is a discrete, it's an institutional event. It's usually contained in the sociology of marriage, and it's formal. It involves, often courts and institutions and lawyers. And but whereas here I was interested in the cultural and to form a relationship. And I connect this to the notion of freedom. One of the purposes of this study was to ask the question of whether freedom is enough, is a strong enough moral ideal to hold relationships and to guide our action. And in fact, this book ended up being, without me really intending to do so at the very beginning, it intended to be a study. It actually ended up being a study of both the effects of freedom and the institutionalization of freedom, because the state of relationships we are living today are very much the product of the sexual freedom that men and women around the world have claimed for themselves throughout the 20th century, and especially after the 1960s. And in fact, I show that, or I try to show rather, that freedom without equality, without gender equality, is actually ends up being a trap and an empty project.
Right. Also, if you could talk a little bit about how unloving helps us in understanding the intersections as well as interconnections between the processes of capitalism, sexuality, gender, and technology. I know it's a broad question, so please take your time.
It's a broad question. So sexual freedom is a project which starts, already in the 19th century, and which advances with unequal speed all throughout the 20th century. And I would say it's a political project and it's a moral project. And sexuality becomes, all throughout the 20th century, but again, especially after the second wave feminist movement, it becomes the site for a rearticulation of women's status in their relationship to men. And I think we are still very much engaged in this process. So on the one hand, you remove religious authority. You remove the religious imposition that described women's virtue as virginity. You remove all those stories that made sexuality a sin. Of course, I'm aware that I'm giving a very very simple, very simplistic view of it, but this was still, I think, one dominant perspective. Freudianism and psychiatry and sexology, all of these very much contribute to actually remove sexuality from the realm of religion, and to not only that, but also to make it then a site for the formation of identity, for the the site for the experience of pleasure, the site for the affirmation of women's equality and freedom. But at the same time, capitalism, consumer capitalism, which actually gets developed very much throughout the same period, seizes on the body and transformed it very much into a sexualized body. And that is a very key component, I think, of sexual freedom. Sexual freedom went hand in hand, actually, with the sexualization and commodification of the sexualized body. That is, the sexualized body was sexualized only to the extent that it was also commodified. For example, simply showing us sex scenes or beautiful, sexy bodies on movies increased their commercial value. That's just an example. Advertising did the same. So so that's one process by which, if you want, sexuality became disentangled from the moral economy in which it was very much entangled previously. Sexuality becomes a kind of autonomous sphere of action. And in becoming an autonomous sphere of action, it justifies very much that men and women, or men and men, women and women, meet each other purely on sexual terms. And meeting on purely sexual terms then has very much consequences, in my opinion, on heterosexuality, because men now have full access to actually all the bodies of women without being really punished or infringing upon accepted norms. But in the sexual encounter between men and women happens quite often on very asymmetrical or very unequal terms. And this inequality between gets deployed within autonomous sexuality is one of the topics of the book. And I would add that this process became accentuated with the emergence of internet dating sites, which contributed to further autonomize the sexual encounter. So where, you know, we moved from the casual sex to even very, very short hookups. And so it is the effect of these encounters, the different effect of these types or forms of encounters on men and women, and on the ways in which each other approach each other, each approach each other, and the ways in which they transform the formation of social bonds, that is, in fact, one of the topics of the book. So really, we see, I mean, the book is really about how consumer capitalism and technology transforms very much sexuality from within and creates new forms of inequalities that I dub emotional inequalities, especially with the emergence of sexual markets. And in sexual markets, the two sides that meet are often meet on unequal terms. I hope I answered you.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, yeah. And since you have brought it up, you know, so I have to ask you if you could talk a little more about how our romantic and intimate lives have been transformed by this dual, you know, processes of capitalism and modernity.
Oh, you know, the connection is very broad. You know, capitalism, consumer capitalism really is the water, it's the ocean in which we swim. And so in many ways, we don't even notice it anymore. So, you know, one way that I can bring up is the shift from calling to dating. Calling was the middle class standard way of courting a woman. It was done often in the home of the woman. You followed a protocol. It was not necessarily chaperoned, but it was under the close scrutiny of kin, neighbors and friends. Dating, which appears and became standardized, a standard practice in around the 1930s, meant something quite different. It meant meeting in the leisure sphere, far away from parents, and it meant consuming together a leisure commodity. And so, you know, historians have paid attention mostly to the transformation of the mode of social control. But no less present in this transformation is the background presence of a leisure commodity. These young people are going out now to consume together a restaurant, a dance, a ride in a car, an ice cream in an ice cream parlor, etc. And so that's one way in which we can first examine the impact of capitalism on romantic life. It transforms dramatically the ways in which courtship happens, and for example, making a marriage no longer the goal of courting. Courtship, in fact, courting when it becomes dating, becomes a series of encounters that are supposed to be pleasurable, that happen in the leisure sphere, and that may or may not end up in marriage. Then, you know, we can think of internet dating sites introduce a market logic in relationships. They, for example, array the people that are available to you as if they were on a supermarket. So the logic of choice, which is a consumer logic, becomes very present. with all the pitfalls of choice, of consumer choice as well. It encourages a sort of commodification of yourself and others by attributing, in values, by reifying others. That would be a second way in which we can find a connection. We can find also a connection in the conflict that can exist between the personality structure that is required for the workplace and the personality structure that is required for durable, durable, loyal relationships. The workplace often demands autonomy, self-reliance, affirmation of the self, etc. Whereas relationships demand quite often of two people a tendency to symbiosis, to dependence, and to self-sacrifice. So in that way, we can say that consumer capitalism very much encourages a form of short-lived and highly commodified form of interaction. And the capitalism that is at work in the workplace is no less, I mean, in a way, no less undermines the personality structure required for durable long-term relationships. Whether those long-term durable relationships are preferable to the short-term ones is up for grabs. It is up for discussion. This is not a side right now I am taking, but I'm simply observing that the new grammar, if you want, of relationships has been very much impacted by capitalism.
Also, you do talk about, heterosexual relations and how they become commercialized also in the context of choice and sexual freedom, which capitalism offers. Would it be possible to talk about this aspect with a few examples as well?
To talk about commercialized relationships in the context of choice?
Yes, choice and sexual freedom.
So I would say, for example, that, think of the venues where you meet people. These venues are entirely commercial. They used to be bars or restaurants or movies. They are now more likely to be internet dating sites. Some of these sites seem to be for free, but in fact, these are sites which function under the principle of EasyJet. That is, they commodify various different aspects of the interaction. So, take Tinder. Tinder will sell you the possibility of looking at the messages of those, seeing who likes you. It will sell you other features as well. It will divide each aspect of the interaction into so many features that are commercialized. First example are the venues in which you meet. Second is, it would be hardly an exaggeration to say how much sexiness, that is being sexually attractive, has become a very fundamental attribute of personhood, of contemporary personhood. Sexiness is actually obtained through the purchase of a vast quantity of consumer goods, which goes from, clothes, cosmetics, perfumes, to removing hair from your legs, to hairdressers, to having purchasing Botox, cosmetic surgery, and so on and so forth. If you took out sexuality or sexual attractiveness somehow from our vocabulary, from our cultural vocabulary, I would bet that a good part of the economy would simply collapse. So central is this cultural notion to the economy. Then I would give maybe another example, which is that men and women still very much meet each other in social occasions in which money is at stake. And the question of who pays remain quite important into the ways in which relationships start. I don't know if you've seen the last movie by Östlund, who was the latest Cannes winner. It's called Triangle of Sadness. And the movie opens up with a sequence. It's a very long and very powerful sequence of a couple, a young couple, who is having an enormous fight over the fact that this is their second date and the woman is not paying. The man feels that she's maneuvering him in order for him to pay, and she took him into this luxury restaurant. And him not being very rich, he very much resents it. So this, I think, very much shows the ways in which these romantic negotiations, these romantic interactions contain also an implicit negotiation about money that is spent in the leisure sphere. And then I would say also think of the fact now that many commodities advertise themselves and sell themselves as romantic commodities. This is something really new. I mean, you know, there are a lot of vacation spots or restaurants or hotels that will advertise themselves as romantic getaways or as having a uniquely romantic atmosphere, which means really that some properties of romantic interaction come to redefine commodities and redefine their nature. So what you're going to do when you consume these commodities is not only consume a vacation proper, but consume certain specific meanings about romanticism. I hope I answered you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes so much sense. And a lot is also said about dating today, dating apps. You did talk about gender very briefly. So what would be the position of women in such a commercialized framework in which love and intimate relations themselves are, you know, commercialized?
So, you know, women play a disproportionate role, actually, in consumer culture. I mean, men buy the heavy goods, like houses and cars, but a lot of the small commodities of consumer culture are bought by women. So, first, I would say that, in general, women play a very active part in consumer culture. But then I would say that given that women have become heavily objectified through their sexuality, and given that sexuality has become mostly a question of adequate consumption, of consuming the right attires and makeup and diets and surgeries and so on and so forth, I would say that in fact women are probably the main conveyor belt of this commercialized hyphen romantic network. That's how I would answer.
Okay. So last question. I want to know, since this is also a niche area of work, do you think that there is further scope for other researchers to work on this area?
Certainly. I mean, I hope very much that people argue with my theories. You know, this conjunction, the intersection between consumer culture and emotions, especially with romantic love and sexuality, is, I think, crucial to understand modern subjectivity. And so I cannot imagine that there wouldn't be a lot of work to do in this area. Yes.
All right.
I would definitely encourage researchers. In particular, I mean, I would be very interested in the comparative analysis of these issues of running, for example, an analysis by analyzing how consumer culture impacts a different romantic practice, different national romantic practices, you know, Israeli, French, or Indian, or American. I think that would be a line of research that would be very important. The second would have to do, I think, with gender and feminism. It would be to figure out whether, as I argue, women are have not been the winners to a certain extent of the sexual revolution. So I would be very happy if some people argued with me on that score. Another area of study that I would find very interesting would be a comparative analysis of heterosexuality and homosexuality and how modes of approach, modes of encounter, of processes of unloving, as I put it, and how freedom is experienced in these different groups. I mean, one of my arguments in the book is that, for example, freedom does not feel as alienating to homosexuals because these couples are a priori more equal, and that heterosexuality has built-in inequality, if you want, that makes freedom more difficult to produce the kind of pleasure and liberation it was supposed to produce.
All right. Actually, the idea of comparing national ways and variations in love sounds very interesting, and I hope someone actually takes it up. Thank you so much, Professor Illouz, for giving me your time and, you know, talking to us about your very interesting book. I hope more listeners, after listening to this conversation, actually go out and pick up your book. So thank you once again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.